not being possessive of anything. And literally this precept in our tradition says a bodhisattva is not possessive of dharma or we could say like resources or material things or wealth. And so that kind of includes everything. So we just say not possessive of anything. But it's traditionally broken into these two parts. And this goes back to the source. Just to hear the source text of these precepts from the Mahayana Brahmajala Sutra. This one says, the eighth major bodhisattva precept prohibits stinginess and insult. So we could say possessiveness is stinginess, holding on to anything. Also, we could see these last three precepts as like greed, hate, and delusion, in a way. Or greed, hate, and greed, anger, and false views, which is like the early list of 10 virtues of the Buddha. They're these kind of body, speech, and mind virtues. So these last three are like mind, like the three basic types of unwholesome minds are like greed, anger, and delusion or false view. But they get elaborated on as precepts here. So this precept is no stinginess and insult. A disciple of the Buddha must not act in a stingy manner. And then, as they say with all of these precepts, or encourage others to do so, or involve oneself in the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of stinginess. So, not being possessive oneself, or encouraging others to be possessive. When a bodhisattva encounters any poor or destitute person who has come to beg, he should give that person anything he needs. Hence, if a bodhisattva directs evil or hateful thoughts at such a person or refuses to give him even a penny, a needle, or a blade of grass, or to speak even a sentence, a verse, or a dust mote's worth of dharma for one who seeks dharma. And if he further scolds and humiliates such a person, he thereby commits a bodhisattva parajika offense, which is like a major, like a defeat of precepts. So in the title it doesn't say dharma or resources, but the commentary breaks it into these parts of dharma and, you know, material things and dharma, not holding back when being asked. And I guess if we were really strict about it, asking could take all kinds of very subtle forms. But the main point is actually our own sense of possessiveness. These are all like study of the self, all these precepts. So do we feel like, I mean, we could apply this to like when we're passing homeless people who maybe aren't actively coming up and asking for something. Do we just feel that sense of like stinginess? I sometimes do. Like, I would like to ignore this person now. Whatever I have with me is I don't want to think about giving it away right now. I have better things to do for myself. So it's that watching that internal attitude of possessiveness. And then in the so that's the sutra, and then Asanga's treatise on the bodhisattva stages. He also mentions this precept, which maybe came before the sutra, even in old India. And it's also worded as not being possessive of dharma or material things. And also interestingly to me, in Asanga's treatise on precepts, Bodhisattva precepts, Asanga is this maybe 4th century Indian teacher and founder of mind-only school and brother of Vasubandhu, who wrote this beautiful treatise on Bodhisattva precepts, going through all the paramitas, but a long expanded list on Bodhisattva precepts. And in that case, he doesn't even mention what we consider like our first 6 Bodhisattva precepts. He doesn't mention them per se, but he says, he talks about Bodhisattva ordination ceremonies and so on and how they're done. And then he says, like with earlier Vinaya precepts, monastic precepts, he says there's these defeats, these parajika for Bodhisattvas. And it's a little different than this sutra. He says there's 4, just like in the Vinaya for monks, there's these 4 defeats where there's, if you break, you're excommunicated, basically, from the community. And for Bodhisattvas, at least if they're broken, he talks about broken in small ways and big ways, but in big ways, it's actually the 4 defeats are the last 4 Bodhisattva precepts for us. So as I see these different sources, to me it's really interesting how these things all kind of got combined together, it looks like, from different sources by the time things got to Dogen in Japan. Or even, actually, this sutra, I would say, this Mahayana sutra, which some people say was written in China, was maybe using Asanga's 4 defeats along with these earlier precepts of like the 5 major precepts. Anyway, interestingly, it's not about killing and stealing and lying and these things for Asanga. The 4 grave offenses for Bodhisattvas are not praising self at the expense of others, or praising self and belittling others, not being possessive of dharma or material things, not being angry to the point, like extremely angry, and not slandering the 3 treasures. For some reason, he chose these as like the major Bodhisattva violations. Maybe because he figured, well, people are already like concerned about not killing and stealing and these basic things, but these are particularly Mahayana Bodhisattva precepts, and they're more about the mind, it looks like, also possessiveness and anger and so on. So not being possessive of dharma, or you could say assets or property or wealth or money, this character is translated as. And then Dogen's comment, which, maybe wouldn't, if you didn't know that this was really about dharma and material things, this commentary would make even less sense than it already does, which Dogen's comments are quite strange anyway. But this is the Kyoju Kaimon of Dogen. So for not being possessive, he says, one phrase, one verse is myriad images and the 100 grasses. So it's one phrase, one verse is referring to dharma teachings. And then myriad images and 100 grasses is like the material world. Images or forms, and grasses, like in the sutra it said not to not even give a blade of grass to someone in need. So it's kind of like the myriad grasses, and it's a poetic way of saying everything, all material things and all dharma things, phrases and verses of dharma. And saying one phrase, one verse is myriad images and 100 grasses. And the comments on Dogen's comments later say that actually all material things are dharma. So if we're being possessive of material things, that is dharma, in the way that you know, the trees and rocks and tiles and pebbles are actually teaching Dharma all the time. And so material things, you know, are anything that can be used to benefit others. Money is actually Dharma. This would be saying any material thing is teaching something, therefore it's Dharma. And all Dharma is likewise can take the form of material gifts. Because not being possessive is the negative, and like G mentioned last week, I think, with these precepts, they have a positive side also. So we could say, instead of not being possessive, we could say be giving, which, you know, kind of goes along with the second precept of stealing too. It seems like the opposite virtue of actually taking what's not given is giving. But this one is even more directly, you know, being possessive versus giving, and the spirit of giving. Because the spirit of possessiveness is more like a mental act. And in accord with this precept, giving is often presented as giving material things, giving Dharma, and giving fearlessness. These three types of giving are usually listed. So we have Dharma and material things, and this precept doesn't say don't be possessive of fearlessness, because maybe what would that be? But I've often found it interesting that one type of giving is giving fearlessness, which could be like actually protecting beings in harmful, fearful situations, like rescuing trapped people or other living beings that are afraid in their situation, like literally kind of rescuing them from fearful situations. But also giving fearlessness could be just being as fearless as possible in a situation where a bunch of people are afraid. And doesn't that actually often work? Doesn't that actually give fear? Everyone's afraid, and someone just actually is like, it's okay, we're just here, it's okay. And it's kind of like, just to be that way could be giving fearlessness. And also part of giving seems to be non-regret. So we, if we give something and then regret it afterwards, in a way it kind of undoes the great merit of the gift. It kind of diminishes our own joy in giving if we regret it afterwards. And like there's this story of one of our Zen ancestors, Kanadaiba Daiyosho, the student of Nagarjuna in our lineage. Kanadeva in Sanskrit. And Kanadeva means one-eyed deva, like one-eyed spirit. And there's this one story of how he got this name. Have you heard this story?
No. Was it a saloon?
Kind of. One-eyed deva. I don't know where, I don't think this story is in the Transmission of Light record. It's maybe one of these Buddhist folk stories that gets passed along. But the story is, he's leaving his teacher, Nagarjuna, and after practicing with him for a long time, and Nagarjuna kind of gives him this kind of test, maybe, or this instruction, the kind of cryptic instruction, like, okay, now you go off into the world and give Dharma freely, and give yourself freely, and give everything. completely. And at some point you will be asked for a major gift. And if you give it without regret, you won't regret it. You'll get back whatever you've given. But if you regret giving it, then it's gone forever and you won't get it back. So he didn't tell him exactly what this would be. But as the story goes, he's walking along the road in India, and a poor crippled beggar is sitting on the side of the road and wailing and in agony and holding his eye and can see him with his one eye and says, sir, please, I need your help. I'm missing my eye and my other eye is going bad. Please, will you give me one of your eyes? Maybe he was slightly deranged to ask for such a thing. And was he even being serious? We don't know. These are stories. But Kamadeva, maybe he even remembered his teacher's instructions, and he's, oh wow, I didn't know it was going to be this big. But he was a great bodhisattva at this point. And so he with some doubt of whether this would really be helpful or not, he somehow reached in and pulled out his eyeball and gave it to this beggar, with great pain himself now, but with this great spirit of bodhicitta and let me give away my body if necessary, and my eye here if it will help. And remembering his teacher's instructions, this, just give this without regret and it won't be a problem. Okay, so he gave him the eye and bowed to him and went on and kind of like wondered what was going to happen here. Don't worry about it, just go on, you gave the gift, but just kind of wondered, right? So turned around and here's the beggar trying to like put the eye into his own eye socket, and of course impossible, he couldn't do it, right? So he got frustrated and just took the eye and just threw it on the ground, and it burst open and was gone. And Kanadeva, advanced practitioner that he was, had just this slight thought of regret for just a moment. Because not only did he give away his eye, but this person couldn't even use it, and it was just wasted and immediately smashed like that. And so from then on, he was one-eyed Deva, Kamadaiba. If he didn't regret it, would he have gotten it back? We don't know. That was what his teacher promised. And what an extreme circumstance to not regret. You give everything. You give the best thing you can possibly give, and it's completely wasted. The person doesn't appreciate it at all. They even get angry because of it. How to not regret such a thing. But that would be true, complete giving, it seems, is to not regret at all. And true non-possessiveness. Like we chant in this section of the Lotus Sutra that we're now chanting in the morning sometimes, some line about when beings are virtuous, gentle, upright, and sincere, not begrudging their own bodily lives, I think is the line. So not being possessive of their own bodies, then I and the assembled Sangha appear on Vulture Peak and teach and appear to be teaching Dharma. So basically, these sincere practitioners who aren't possessive of anything see the Buddha teaching Dharma. And, you know, hopefully we don't aren't in such an extreme situation as Kanadeva to have to give up our eyeball in vain. But what is not begrudging our own bodily lives? Maybe it's in our just daily zazen practice to just sit still and upright when it's uncomfortable. In a way, it's not being stingy with our upright posture, we could say. Offering that as a gift to the Buddha and the Sangha. So possessiveness and true giving seems to be, as all these precepts have a kind of ultimate level or a root. A root dharma to contemplate, to understand the precept most deeply. It seems like possessiveness is around basically just the sense of a separate self. That as soon as there's a me, there's mine. They go together. And Nagarjuna in his chapter, in his verses on the self, the false independent self, talks about this and says, basically, as soon as there's me as a separate I, then there's mine, and that can be like the whole world. My whole world of experience arises from the view of I. So at the deepest, ultimate level, where there is no I, there is no possessiveness. So the precept of no possessiveness is to realize that nothing can be possessed because there's no I to possess. And as with all these precepts, this deep ultimate level, that's what Dogen is often emphasizing. And I think we really can open to this level of precepts, even if it's not fully realizing in a non-stop way, no independent self. In situations that we feel possessive, can we remember this teaching of no independent self, no separate self, no abiding self, and therefore what we think of as mine isn't really mine. I think this came up also in the discussion around the precept of not taking what's not given, but same principle. And it's so deep. I almost feel like in some ways to hear the teachings about no independent self, just, you know, at the moment, it almost seems like it's easier to take that up. It's easier to hear that than to hear about not mine. It's easier to hear about not me than not mine, which is, I think, shows us something about that we don't. If we feel that, we're not deeply seeing the full impact of no me, because no me means no mine. So if we, so if it seems like, oh yeah, no independent self, like I'm just actually part of the flow of everything, but then we feel like, but actually, that's my car, my house, or whatever. You know, that's actually harder now. You know, don't push me on that one. And I would say we're not really deeply seeing the full impact of no me. Of course, we do have these conventions of mind, things that of possessiveness, and things that we possess. And it's not a problem. I think that the world is set up that way, and we function that way, and we keep track of things in such a way, but to look really deeply and to not really believe that we own anything, I think is very challenging to our sense of self. And we get tested on this, you know, every day. So, in my own life, I feel like one way that I'm being tested these days around this possessiveness thing is my partner, Shoho, is who's been living part-time down here in Santa Cruz in my little place across the green here, and part-time up in the mountains is soon moving down here full-time. And I think we're both feeling the impact of this precept around where we share this. It's like basically one room. And so this sense of possessiveness, right, of personal space, and how it's, and it's not so hard actually to just share the personal space in many ways, but it's, you know, she's got all these ideas. Well, if I'm really living here full time, then I want to kind of like remodel it, redecorate it, you know, change it around, change the furniture, change the altar, change the artwork and these things. And I feel like my self-sense, right? It's like my identity. I'm, you know, really, we both are very kind of independent-minded people, so I think this is going to be, I'm actually looking forward to it as a practice thing. And it's really, it's going to push me. And I just, I'm so used to actually having my own space and creating my world in my space there. And very particular, you know. And sitting these last days, we've had this sesshin just ended today. Very small sesshin. And just today, thinking a little bit about, like, you know, trying one of these things, and sometimes when getting deeper into sesshin, bringing up, okay, like, where am I holding on? Where am I grasping? And can I release? And like these ideas, visions, hasn't really happened yet, right? But what's it going to be like here? And because we've been talking about it a little bit, she's like, I think the altar is going to move over there, and we should change this and move these books out of here. And like, well, okay, well, let's talk about this later. But when I think about it in Zazen, I think it goes right to the root of the sense of self in this beautiful way. And when I like can release that sense of self in deep Zazen, I feel totally like welcome to like, okay, go change the place all around, like do whatever you want. And like and because it's all just this illusory world of non-possessiveness, and it can kind of touch that place for short times, right, and really feel joyful about it, and then see how it can so easily the habit mind can be like that mind of like no, don't let that happen, you know, that mind is so close by, so ready to just like, you know, well, we're going to compromise here, and we're going to like, and which in fact probably will be the case. With, you know, let's be realistic. And yet, there's this wonderfully joyful mind about just like, I don't care how this place is. You know, it's not like she's going to like make a huge mess of it. It's going to be beautiful, but it's like it's more about my identity and possessiveness of. Not even really so much the space in this case. It's like possessiveness of like an identified with like kind of like a realm of me. Like I set up me in the physical world. I'm a very physical and visual oriented person. So this is how I'm working with this precept. material and Dharma, giving and non-possessiveness. So I could say more, but maybe you all have things to bring up around this, or how you might be practicing with possessiveness.
Well, I think the example that you're bringing up is probably one of the best ways that I think we do get challenged, you know, and I think that it's interesting that, you know, you're saying, you know, you can sit and think about, oh yeah, no self, yeah, sure, but when it's that, oh, but that's mine, then who, you know, it really brings that out of the theoretical realm.
Yeah.
But then, you know, in a relationship, there's that balance of boundaries. And this whole thing, I know we talk about a lot of, you know, too much form, too much emptiness. Because, you know, in the name of being non-possessive, you know, and I'm not saying you and your partner do this, obviously, but, you know, we can walk all over each other in the name of, I can't claim that, that's not mine, you know. Mm. And so there's this edge of, you know, I don't know, I guess I wonder, is there something about boundary that's healthy and valuable, but that's not necessarily about possession? And I'm asking that question not knowing the answer, but it's like when I think about grappling with this Dharma question in the realm of relationship and space, especially, it can't be that the answer is, well, she gets to do everything she wants. Mm. Because, like, well, wait a minute, what's that about?
Yeah, it's a great question.
About her opportunity to practice letting go of her ideas. You know, and allow her that opportunity as well.
It's so tricky. Because, it's like allowing it, especially if both people or many people are really trying to practice with the same kind of stuff. And yet, I don't know either, actually, about where that's at, because I think there is something that's valuable about that dance of compromise and boundary, and it's like, it's interactive, it's not one-sided, it's passive, it's much more dynamic than just completely one person giving. And yet, I also see the beauty as an ideal, maybe, or something, of just giving as much as possible, and trusting that everybody, at least anyone we're close to, also has that in mind, and so it doesn't get one-sided. Now, sometimes we might feel like it is, and you know. Often it seems like one person feels like they're giving too much, but the other person also feels like they're giving too much, so then maybe it is about right. But I don't know, maybe other people have something to say about how, maybe the crux of the question is, can there be this kind of compromising discussion where at the most ideal sense, no possessiveness at all in there? I think that's the question. Because I think there definitely is something about this dance and this giving and giving and holding and holding, and yet usually, even though that dance might be quite beautiful, usually there is this selfish possessiveness mixed in with it also, right? So in the highest ideal of such a precept, that's, I guess, would be my question, is can there be such a dance really free from possessiveness? Like, we're doing this dance as just pure, pure giving. What do you think?
Unlike you, I haven't always had a space of my own to create.
Mm.
I'm 56 now, and just a few years ago got my own room for the first time. And in our relationship, it was one of the healthiest things, I think, that happened. To allow individuation to occur. Fully Kathy, fully me. And in that, with two whole individuals, the possessiveness kind of falls away in my experience. And I think this is a little bit like not ignoring causes and conditions and also not being caught by them. It's kind of acknowledging, you know, you have the life you have, and that might include wanting your altar just so. There's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong, but is it, you know, is it grasping, attachment, and therefore suffering?
The question about whether it's suffering is only yours to answer, really. Is it kind of, no, this is just the way things are, and I'm at ease with that, and if it changes, that's fine, if it doesn't change, that's fine? Or is the grasping itself creating its own cycle of further grasping?
Yeah, it seems like we have, like, our current translation of the Xin Xin Ming, and we say, like God says, the great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. Because sometimes we say, have no preferences, but I think we do have preferences, is maybe what you're pointing at. And I think, and it doesn't seem a problem to have preferences, but then to hold them is where we grasp them, and that's when trouble comes. So, but in this case, right, it's like, yeah, it seems like it's not so much a problem to say, oh, I want the altar this way, and even if there's, like, it's just maybe even a strong preference if nobody else has a problem, but then if she's got a problem with it and wants to change it, that's when it's like, then it becomes, what wasn't a problem now has become like, I have to say, like, no, it's not going to change, but we, you know.
Well, that's that place of insisting at the expense of another is when, in my view, it becomes objectifying, right?
And possessiveness.
And then it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as there's not objectifying, it just, this is what's arising.
Yeah. Or we could say flexibility or something.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's a lot of gray area in there of like, well, kind of flexible around some of these things, but like, I have my limits, you know. And yeah. But, you know, for how would it look, maybe another way to theoretically pose this kind of question was like for truly awakened bodhisattvas, free of any sense of independent self, but that are still living in the material world like all bodhisattvas do, and they have to agree on something, and they have different ideas about that, and good reasons for different ideas. How is that going to happen with those? How would that happen with those bodhisattvas? And maybe the point being, or the answer arises to the question as I ask it, is if it's like that, then it's kind of like, well, I have this idea that this would be more helpful for everyone, and this one has. I have the idea that actually this would be more helpful for everyone. Then that's like a bodhisattva argument. And not so bad, however it turns out, maybe not so bad. But as a maybe non-bodhisattva argument is, I think things would be better this way for me. I think things would be better this way just for me. And then it's like, then it's a different kind of situation. Yeah?
Well, you know, what I see as you're talking, I'm amused because I do this too. I mean, it's like, all of this is leaping ahead. I mean, you aren't even in the moment where you're actually together with your stuff, seeing how moment to moment you're do it.
We've had some discussions.
You don't know anything yet. And there are all these ideas about it that are already just, you know, like, really grabbing you.
So some of it actually works out when you start actually moving furniture around and stuff.
Know, so to trust that, let's see, we're going to just get in there with each other and literally, you know, with the stuff.
Yeah.
Do your dance with the space that you've got and the time that you've got. It's so hard to trust that.
And some of it's like, you know, discussions about, well, we need to actually plant, we need to get another shelf or build an altar at Jikoji before she leaves, or these kind of things. So there's some, which maybe isn't such a good idea, to be building things before you're actually in the space, but part of it's coming out of that, you know. It's getting kind of real already. But I think you're right, too, that a lot of things happen as they happen. Things, surprising things get worked out. But I think the most impactful part of this for me was actually just using this as a catalyst to meditate on the self. Mm-hmm. And like, can I actually momentarily like drop like that, you know, self concern and watch how there's then, and actually have the vision, even though it is just a vision, but have a vision of like, oh, however things will go here, it really will just be like this joyful, like, expression of life. And to see how, like, to actually taste that vision momentarily and see, oh, this could be a way to live. This could be a way to live. And when it comes right down to it, it probably won't be sustainable. And that could apply to everything. And the layers and layers of possessiveness and ownership and time is another one. Possessiveness of time. You know, it's not a physical thing or a Dharma teaching, but it's like, how do we share our time with each other? And how to be, like, have no fixed agenda, I think would be this vision I have is like, we do have our karmically conditioned nature, but to just be like constantly letting that go, and it still arises in a conditioned way, in a particular way, but meeting everything so freshly that that there's no possessiveness. May such thing be possible.
It seems like there's another aspect, and maybe related to Kandaiva's story, that if freely giving of oneself in a way that doesn't bring forth regret kind of is predicated on that the request is reasonable.
Yes. Yeah.
Equal shared responsibility for the outcome of this.
Yeah, there was maybe even something in Asanga's comments about this, like the giving, the request reasonable and the giving actually beneficial. So there could be requests for something that really wouldn't be beneficial to give. And there are all kinds of subtlety to that too. In which case, the giving could be to not give. You know, somebody wants a gun or something, right? Well, you know, I think it'd be better not to give you this. And all kinds of lesser examples, that especially amongst practitioners. But I think it gets tricky whenever we say, I think this would be good for this person's practice, and this is dangerous territory. Although bodhisattvas should be up for such possibilities, I think. Still, it's, I think this is like a very cautious territory to go into. Maybe we have, maybe bodhisattvas have to go in there, actually, but very cautiously and ruthlessly self-scrutinizing and honest, I think, is the key way to go in there safely. Because if there's any sense of like, this would be good for your practice and me, you know, really, actually, it would help me out. We dedicate this Dharma gathering to the realization of non-possessiveness among all living beings. Beings are numberless. I long to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.